This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Timps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're revisiting the theme of comedy as a factor in mental health, something that I love discussing and I feel so privileged to get to interview and indeed know so many comedians at this point. And in particular, our guest today, Stephanie Foster, I sat down with just before she kicks off a national tour in the US that really highlights all the links here for me. I mean, really, her work justifies this theme so easily. And we had a very organic chat because she's doing a tour around sorority houses, talking about mental health and in particular suicide prevention via the format of comedy. And it's such empowered work. She was a delight to talk to. And while suicide is something that we've talked about many a time on the show, and I certainly make a rule to not shy away from it ever, there can still be ways in which every experience relating to this is so distinct. And Stephanie just highlights so many of the misconceptions that can exist alongside the ways in which she's found hope after something that really shook her world. And, you know, I don't think it's a cliche at all to say that, you know, I can see how much that her friend's life lives on in her work today. And so I was really glad to sit down with her before the tour commences, get to record both an episode for this podcast and also a crossover one on Dating Games, the Modern Relationships podcast. So this afternoon, we talked a lot. And I'm sure, like me, you'll get so much from this conversation that has its really moving moments, but also there's a lot of humour in there. And if there's one thing I really appreciate from interviewing comedians more and having a whole comedy slant podcast these days, it's that I'm also getting so much more comfortable bringing comedy into sensitive conversations around mental health and asserting that there is a place for humour and that this is part of the way that we normalise such difficult topics and we bring them down to size so that they can be something we can kick around and discuss and live with in a different kind of way. Because sometimes it can be one thing to work through our challenges and another to get used to talking about them. And yeah, that's something I can be reminded of all the time, as I actually talk about in the other episode on dating games. There can always be ways that we uncover areas of mental health and conversations around it that are still uncomfortable, and we still need work at getting used to those conversations. So much to say, but I will leave it at that and really hope you appreciate this interview with Stephanie Foster in a moment. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
Hi, my name is Stephanie Foster, and I think the first time I was aware of my mental health was in sixth grade. I was dating this guy that was much older than me, and my parents found out, and I had to break up with him. And I remember that was the first time I experienced suicidal ideation. It was just one of those moments of, you know, at that age, I was in middle school. I hadn't thought about what it might feel like to actually want to take your own life. That had never crossed my mind before. But it wasn't until, oh my gosh, much later in my 20s that I actually started to take responsibility for my mental health. I think once I started down that exploration is when I found out I actually had a mental illness. And that was even tougher to cope with of, oh my gosh, something's wrong with me. I'm different. I'm broken. No one's going to want to be with this kind of feelings. Yeah, but I think the more that I sit with it and the more time and space I give to my own mental illness, my mental health and the mental health of those around me, the more comfortable I am talking about it, which I think is why I do comedy, right? Like, it gives me the venue and the avenue to be able to go and say whatever I want, as long as I make it funny.
Mm-hmm. And I definitely want to circle back on that, because I think a lot of people need that juxtaposition when it comes to difficult conversations in order to make sort of ease down the medicine of the conversations we all need to be having more. But for now, I want to kind of dig into a little bit more of what you said about your middle school experiences there, because it must have been something so stark to experience, really, that awareness coming around suicidality. So am I right in thinking there were, looking back now, there were symptoms of mental ill health, but it wasn't until it got to that level of extremeness that you couldn't not notice it, or maybe had to face things that you were perhaps overlooking?
Yeah, it's one of those things that, you know, mental illness is so hard for you to discover for yourself, because all you know is your own normal. So you think that whatever you're experiencing between your two ears is what everybody else must be experiencing too. And so I grew up in a really small town in Texas, and the vibe there is like, you know, suck it up, buttercup, and just keep pushing it down and put on a happy face and keep moving and you're fine. And I think that was like the first time in my life all of those feelings caught up with me. I was so scared of my own brain in that moment. I just was so terrified to tell anyone else that that was happening for me, because I just felt like, I am going to be in trouble. This is a bad thought.
Yeah. And I can see how an environment like that, where you were encouraged to really live your emotions in a very repressed way, could contribute to those feelings, because you can get to a place in your head where it's like, oh, I'm really clear on what my expectations are, the kind of person I should be. And now I've reached a point where I've pushed certain struggles down so much, and I can't resist this feeling anymore that maybe I can't live up to who people expect of me.
Absolutely. I think that's actually what was the catalyst for me, was everything was going completely right in my life and I was miserable. And I just was so confused, because I thought my entire life, like, get the partner, get the job, get the amazing life where you travel. I mean, I was an expat living in Barcelona, working part-time, doing comedy part-time and constantly traveling. Why wasn't I happy? I had it all, right? Mm-hmm. And it just still was like, wow, something is really missing for me here. Exactly to your point of just like, there's just something different, and I have to address it, because I see like living life is so different for my friends and the people around me compared to what I'm going through, I think is the best way I can put it.
Yeah. No, it's really tricky to even put words to this stuff. And I experience that a lot, even making a show like this, that the way I describe certain experiences in my past changes a lot. And I sometimes wonder if that comes off as inauthentic. But the reality is, we constantly have new ways to frame our past experiences based on what we're learning today. And so even the things that can feel, you know, really solid at the time, like, it was interesting what you mentioned about growing up and maybe assuming at times that what you're going through is what everyone's going through.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we can both like really have that and really not have that as a young person, that on one mm-hmm. hand, we can be encouraged to kind of think of like, other people have it worse. We all have struggles. Life is tough, particularly like if parents are going through things, we can really see, oh, adulthood is tough, childhood is tough. I guess I don't say anything, I just plod on. And so you've got that stuff, but almost exactly parallel, you can have this feeling of isolation and I'm not expressing my feelings and neither is anybody else. And so maybe this is just a me thing. And it's sort of wild how we can look back and be like, oh, even the stuff that really informed who I was can be entirely contradictory. No wonder being an adult and going to therapy is confusing.
Right? And like, to your point, of course, my experience is going to look and feel different with how much time I've spent with it versus like beating myself up for feeling different about the exact same thing or the experience feeling different. I think like part of it is when big things happen to us, the shock absorber of life is denial. And so we can only take part of our experience at a time because otherwise it's just too much to handle.
Yeah, you're so right there. And it's such a default that we can go to and it doesn't work, but we keep trying it and we keep being encouraged to try it. But I do see, and I'm sure you do with your work, how like the needle is moving forward. Like we can look back at how we were raised around a lot of these conversations versus how young people are today. And, you know, one of the big things that was a shock to me as I got older and I really worked on and delved into a lot of the stuff that I've been shying away from was how much power we can actually draw from being authentic and being open about the emotions and the vulnerabilities we can have that make you think like, oh no, but then I'm vulnerable. Then I'm in a weakened position. And it's like, no, actually, your emotions can be quite intimidating because so many people are busy pushing theirs down.
That is so fair. I think a big fear going into this tour was having to talk about the extremely painful loss of one of my closest friends night after night after night. But after the dry run, I felt relief. I felt lighter. I felt less alone. I felt the opposite of all of those things that I thought I would feel. You know, I think when you experience a death from someone so close to you or just anything traumatic, at the end of the day, you are, for lack of a better phrase, dying to talk about it. You know, you just want someone to just hear you out because you're going through all of these things, but you, to your point earlier, have an equally big pressure of that fear of not wanting to burden people. And I think that is what I've really had to fight through, is getting past that feeling that I am a burden for reaching out.
Yes. And I think that is such an important message, because how often does that come out in suicidality, that people can get to a place that is so dark that they do think, I'm such a burden, everyone would be better off without me. And when you hear a lot of the ignorant things people can say around suicide, it does tend to circle back to that of like the idea of it being selfish, the idea of it being an easy way out. And for me, as someone that's kind of worked in this space and done work, including for Samaritans, a suicide prevention hotline, I just hear that and I can tell right away. That's the biggest flag of telling me that you've never been there and you simply don't understand. Because when someone's in such a dark place, they already feel like they're the world's biggest burden and that they are like a toxin that's encroaching on everyone else's space.
Well, I think that's the thing too, right, Bobby? Is like people who don't experience it want it to make sense. And unfortunately, mental illness does not make sense. An example would be, I was getting my hair done the other day, and it's one of my favorite activities. I love when people play with my hair. It's supposed to be the most enjoyable 2 hours of my life, right? I'm sitting in the car. My dog is in the car. It's 60 degrees outside. I have the windows down. It's a normal day. And my anxiety is telling me both that my dog is going to freeze to death and that my dog is going to overheat to death at the same time. Technically, those two things cancel each other out, so we should be fine. Like, but that's not how it works. Like, logic does not come into play here. It doesn't come into play with my depression, my anxiety, my suicidal ideation. Like, now here in this present moment, I know it would be world-crushing to so many people in my life had I not made the choice to stay alive. But in that moment, I am in such a fog, I can't find that reality. And so I think for people who don't experience it, if none of that makes sense, just nod your head and say, okay, I'm here.
Yes.
That's all we need. We're not trying to make sense to you. We don't make sense to ourselves, which is pretty unnerving.
Yes, indeed. And I would go further than that even and say it's, you know, it's such a privilege in many ways to not understand, to have not been in places dark enough to be able to relate firsthand. And, you know, whilst we all have our struggles when it comes to mental health, there are levels to this. And so, like you say, believe us is a really great way to start, in the same way we would encourage people to believe, like, people of colour when they talk about racism. We'd encourage men to listen to women when they talk about the kind of sexism that can be so normalised, to the extent where, you know, even as guys that try and be clued in on this stuff, we can still miss it because we are not usually the target. But really, at the end of the day, we are coming at the world from our perspective. And it's not our default to kind of step outside of that unless there's kind of sometimes a need to. Do you mind sharing a little bit about what happened with your friend and the kind of influence that had on your life?
So JC and I were best friends in college in our sorority. We were what you would call twins in a sorority, which means you have the same big, which is like an older sister. God, this feels horrible to say out loud.
This is all just new to me.
So JC and I were best friends in college. And in college, I was very shy and had a really tough time with my big personality and how loud I am. And it would be to the point where I would like cover my mouth when I laughed or when I ate, because I just didn't want, I don't know, to be too much. And JC did not know the definition of too much. It was not in her vocabulary. And so she definitely brought that side out of me and celebrated that side of me. When I left Texas pretty immediately after college, Colorado, then California, and Jace and I stayed in contact a ton. And, you know, we were really in contact a lot during the pandemic because we're both single women living alone in lockdown. It was really hard. It was really hard. And it was May of 2020. And I had gone to the park to do like a parking with some friends when I found out that she had died by suicide. You know, it's as awful as anyone imagines. But I think the hardest part for me was, because I struggle with it myself, I was like, all right, I am going to figure out the why and the why now. And I just have to get to the bottom of this. I should have known. It was my sole responsibility because I struggle with this. I was putting a lot of additional pressure on myself that was self-induced. So I just want to make that clear. I do not think any of those things anymore. But in my search to figure out that why, I realized I had not responded to 5 of her last text messages. And that guilt drowned me for a long time. And, you know, that dark voice that some of us have just was telling me again that it was all my fault. And had I been a better friend, she'd still be here. And I think, you know, working with a therapist and honestly being able to look back at that time, I saw how depressed I was in that moment and that I had not showered in a week. I had not left my own house. I was not whole enough to respond. And now I use me not responding to text messages as a sign that I need to reach out for help. I no longer have the guilt of it. What I've learned about suicide is that no one dies by suicide for one specific reason. It is not a job loss. It is not a loss of a partner. It is not a friend not responding to your texts. It is so much bigger than that. Suicidal ideation needs motivation like nobody's business. And so one simple act can't motivate it. It's not big enough. So yeah, that's my story about JC. You know, it's still, as you can hear, my voice is shaking. It's still hard to talk about. There's still some shame surrounded by that and telling this at larger audiences all the time. The shame goes away a little bit more. But that is my story about Jace.
Thank you. And I'm so glad that you shared that particular part about the self-blame that can be such a common element of how do any of us wrap our minds around suicide? And in trying to rationalize it, that can come out in all kinds of ways that can be a detriment to our mental health. And even in these really dark times, there's still always a necessity to make sure that we're okay. And like you said, this is so far from something that people do impulsively. And I think that's one of the kind of most ignorant misconceptions that can exist, that someone just wakes up one morning and decides that this is the day they die by suicide. And, you know, that negates just the sheer weight of what that mindset is to be in that place. So I really appreciate you sharing that. And the only other thing I'll add is to a previous point where I mentioned about how, you know, sometimes we need a reason to step outside of our own perspective and really try and understand other people. And I think for a lot of us, we do that tons. And a lot of us, we have less of that in our life. But whoever you are, I mean, there's definitely people that could do with a bit more of a perspective in their life. Anyway, whoever you are, these things will happen. Whether it's suicide or not, there will be things in your life that stop you dead and make you question everything. And so if we can find the opportunities earlier on, even though it's uncomfortable, even though it's scary, even though it can mean acknowledging difficult truths of ourselves, we will be in such a better place to understand ourselves and others later down the road. And maybe that helps with some of the guilt. I don't know.
I think you're spot on, right? When you go through something like this, you have all of this extra energy and you can put it in a lot of different things. I actually got sober after JC's death. And I think it was a lot just due to having to figure out how to keep living with the thing you'd never thought you'd have to lose, right? Everybody's got that thing. My thing was Jace. Some people it's a job, some people it's something completely different, right? But I think if you're able to give light and space to the most painful things in your life, those have now become the most beautiful things in my life. Like talking about JC gives me so much joy because I don't know how many families, but I know there will be fewer families who have to go through what Jace's family went through. And like getting to say her name and joke about her and her be a part of something that is meaningful, but still like we curse and say horrible jokes at the same time. Like that was JC's spirit. And I think part of it is like, yeah, it's painful to think that I didn't respond, but it's equally beautiful to know that she fought. It's so wonderful to know that she wanted to live and she did reach out. That gives me so much joy. I would take the pain of not responding every day of the week to have that.
Yeah.
So I think like my message is just like, don't push those things down. Go and explore those things and give them light. And if you need to do it with, you know, a trained professional like I did, do that too. But I think I just tried to shy away from the things I was so scared of about myself, be it this mistake I felt like I made or my mental illness in general. Like the more I'm willing to go near it, the less scary it becomes.
Yes. That's so real because it can be so incredibly isolating. And, the cruel irony that if you had reacted to this as 100% understandable as it would have been by retracting into yourself and pulling away from the people you love and not talking about somebody that you of course still care about, then how much that isolation could affect your health. And, you know, that's, I think we're safe to assume, the last thing that she would want.
Absolutely. And like, let's be clear, I did that for a few months at first. I dipped my toe into that pool for sure, the isolation pool. But yeah, I'm very glad I'm on a different side of that and just being able to bring it out into the open more. So one of the things that I'm really trying with this comedy tour is to get people to identify like when they're starting to get low, right? Have you heard of the frog in the pot analogy?
I have.
Yeah. Do you know it? Tell it if you know it.
No, I do, but I'm sorry that I might ruin your fun. So yeah, the analogy is that if you put a frog in a pot of water and gradually turn up the temperature, because of how gradual that happens, the frog will end up cooking because it doesn't realize the temperature increase if it's slow enough. The annoying thing about that is, whilst it's a really good analogy and definitely has mental health applications, it's not actually accurate in terms of it will get to a point where the frog is like, this is too hot, and it will leave.
Right.
But I really appreciate the sentiment.
Yes. Okay. I totally agree with that. But using the analogy in a general form, mm-hmm. it's just trying to do like, what are the first things I start to do versus, oh man, I'm already deep down in this tunnel and now it feels impossible to get out. And so I think those are the interesting things, right? Like I do horribly embarrassing things that are kind of things that I need to work on. And then the other thing is obviously not responding to texts is now when I'm like, okay, I need to start reaching out. Do you do anything weird when you start to feel yourself get low, or like anything interesting that you feel like is maybe unique?
I like to say that a lot of them I'm sort of like fairly in check on now. But there's definitely, I don't know, maybe there are ways that I respond could be perceived as weird. I from quite a young age, used to like prescribe myself naps because I'd realized that I was just like getting angry or grouchy or like really emotional about things. And, you know, taking a moment to breathe from it, you know, maybe like going to my room or something and taking a moment and being like, now that I've stepped away from this situation, it doesn't actually quite hold up in the light that I should be feeling this emotional. And actually, now I do think about it, I didn't sleep last night. And so, yeah, that's something I used to do from quite a young age, is be like, I think we need a nap right now. And just treat, sometimes we have to sort of like baby ourselves like that and be like, yeah, okay, this is what you need.
You sound like such a well-adjusted toddler.
I'll take that.
I'm just learning that still in my 30s. Are you kidding? That's incredible.
Yeah, I mean, there's still a lot of work that's kind of gone along the way. You know, there were definitely things that needed examining that a nap wasn't quite bridging the gap for when I was younger. I actually remember a previous guest talked about this idea of like a train whistle coming. And that mm-hmm. was like her early detection system for depression, that she'd start sort of noticing like the feelings begin to bubble up. And with work, noticing them sooner and sooner was kind of like a train whistle where she could hear it real far off in the distance and she could take action to kind of divert it before it even got close. And I was like, yeah, I had that moment of like, show me how. Give me your secrets. And the answer is a lot of time working on yourself. There is no shortcut.
Isn't that so annoying? I feel like every time I ask my therapist, I'm like, okay, but what do I do about it? She's like, work on it slowly. So frustrating.
Yeah, and you're sort of like, I believe you, but also that is convenient to you having loads more sessions with me. That's a profitable solution for you.
Right? Yeah, I would say it's going to take a while too if I was hourly.
And to be fair, I have a wonderful counselor that I've been with for 4 years. And yes, sometimes I do see her with a like new Louis Vuitton bag. And I think I've probably paid for one of those by now, but you are 100% worth it because, you know, how much you learn and like all the ways now that I'm reminded of situations where, you know, she points them out, but often I just notice them of like, oh, I've just told you about a thing that would have floored me even a year ago, would mm-hmm. have set me back for weeks. And now I'm like, oh, and then that happened and the next day I felt okay. So something more important to tell you about. And I just, you know, rumble through these things.
Oh, yeah, it's interesting. I now can't imagine not having a therapist now that I like have that tool in my toolbox, if you will. I'm really aware that it's a privilege to have a therapist, and I feel so lucky to have one. And I think for me, it's just someone there to like pick up on the patterns that I'm too far in the weeds on to pick up on. Mm-hmm. And then once she does, first of all, it's annoying. Then I'm like, okay, but it's fixable, which to me feels really good. I'm a fixer. And then I have a task. And who doesn't love a project? Yes. I'm just the project today.
Yeah. And I think the more you work on this stuff, the more that you can get really into that. Like I now mm-hmm. I'm at a stage where I love overcoming new things to work on as opposed to that striking fear in me. And I think you'll be able to relate to this because whilst every counselling environment is different, one of the things I really value with my therapeutic relationship is like we really do have fun and we do like have a laugh. And yes. like I make her laugh all the time with like some of the ridiculous like thought processes that I have. And that's actually, you know, that wouldn't be for everyone. You know, every dynamic forms differently. But that definitely is very helpful for me because sometimes it feels like 100% the correct response is to be like, and she just giggles away.
Right. And I need that, right? Because that's part of my personality mm-hmm. is using humor to get through this. I think a lot of people ask like, why stand up and all of those things? How does that mix? And it's like, that's how I communicate. That's how everyone around me knows I'm okay. Like if I can joke about it, I'm bigger than it. I'm going to get through it. And so, yeah, it may be a horrible joke or perhaps not the words you would have chosen, but like, that's how I tell my story. And so I kind of need someone on the other line who speaks the same language or feels like they get it. Or otherwise I don't really want their advice. Mm. Is that what it's like for you or how do you choose a therapist?
Yeah, so I did go private. I knew that I wanted long-term therapy and to do with waiting lists and to do with the amount of time I thought I'd probably need. It seemed that private was going to be the route. And, you know, again, like you said, there's a privilege to that. And there's also, you know, there have been many a week where I've not had the money. And so mm-hmm. we've had to skip. And so it's not, you know, it's not necessarily even the perfect solution, but it's yep. something that's really worked for me. And I tried to go into choosing a therapist in a way that was very honest, you know, don't judge myself of like what I'm looking for. Just be like, look, you need somebody that you're comfortable with and whoever that person is. And so for mm-hmm. me, it was someone, I think I was erring more towards a woman and I was erring more towards person of color or certainly somebody mm-hmm. from a minority background, because at the time yeah. I was living in the UK and as an Irish person, I particularly living in Birmingham, you know, this was an honest reflection of my life experiences that I had been around people from other minority backgrounds. I'd been around a lot of like strong, incredible, inspiring women that were mm-hmm. so expressive and caring with how they showed emotion and how they showed care. And so that felt like the kind of the default safe space for what I was looking for, I guess. I'm not sure if I've really shared that before. And so yeah, my counselor's from a second generation Jamaican background, and there's a lot of parallels between like Jamaican culture and Irish culture, and particularly in relation to living in England and the history there. And so that was something that was really important to me, of like there were certain things I didn't want to have to explain. And you know, I think also we got on because of other reasons as well, like we did share humor, we shared a certain frankness that neither of us, you know, I'm sure she's different with her different clients, but neither of us felt we needed to hold back in certain ways on, you know, on humor and being blunt about our opinions about the world at times. And, you know, I think that's so important, that therapy is many things, but I don't think it's the environment to think too complexly about who you feel comfortable with. You can explore that with the person. Just find someone you can talk to and be open with, and anything else can be explored after the fact.
Yeah, I love that. And you know what I really love that you said is that it's not a perfect solution. And I think that's great. It's a solution. And sometimes it's like in this mental health journey, you want this one fix, quick pill thing. Let's get it over with and get it out of me. When in reality, it's like, how do I live with this and manage it and accept it as what I am, what I am experiencing, you know?
Mm-hmm. And could you share how comedy's been a part of that journey?
Absolutely. I think it's like, there's hardly a time I go and talk about my mental health on stage where someone doesn't come up after me and say, "Ooh, me too." And to just not feel alone in it is so beautiful. And I use comedy just to start a conversation. Like, I'm not a mental health expert. I just have a mental illness and I lost one of my best friends to something similar. And so I know what it feels like to lose people from it. And that's what I talk about. I know what it feels like to experience it myself and how maddening it can be. So that's why I talk about it. I think comedy just gives me the entrance and the door to be able to. Otherwise, it'd be very weird if I just went up to restaurants and started doing this, you know? It'd be very odd, especially in America. I think it would be imprisoned quickly. But comedy, you get the ticket to say, like, the best way I've heard a comedian described is you're someone on the debate team that someone actually wants to talk to. So you have an opinion, you have this view on life that you're ready to share, but you can only share it if it's funny. And so it's a real challenge to be able to do all of things, but I like that challenge because sometimes just someone going to be sad on a stage isn't going to help another sad person. They've got to feel the hope there. And there's something about laughing at it that just gives you a little hope.
Yeah. Yeah, that just makes these massive, difficult topics just that little bit smaller and more digestible. Mm-hmm. And in particular, what you mentioned there about processing stuff on stage really interests me, because a big part of the conversation around mental health and comedy these days is appropriateness and where the line is of, like, kind of putting therapy on your audience versus coming to them with things you've worked on and you know, sharing your insights in a way that, you know, you're not expecting therapy from paying audience members, you're expecting them to come and laugh and have a good time and not worry about you. And I definitely want to hear your perspective on it, but I think the thing that I've been thinking about recently on it is that there probably is a middle ground where you know, we ideally want it to be nearer the latter, but I think there is still benefit to processing in the kind of later dragging on stages that can be quite difficult. So whilst we're not sort of saying things on stage for the first time that are very traumatic, that makes sense more to tell your counsellor. It also doesn't have to be perhaps things that you're perfectly comfortable with, because the conversations that most need to be had often are the ones that are tricky and that need the jokes to kind of ease them and explore them. And, you know, comedy is partly a process of you figuring out the right wording and drilling down on your own perspective. And I kind of think that that's okay too.
Absolutely. I think it's a sliding scale. Like, for me, I don't know what it's like for all comics, but I wouldn't be saying it into a mic on stage unless I had processed it to a point where I felt comfortable doing that. And, like, while we say a lot of stuff on stage, you'll hardly find me talking on stage about something I'm currently experiencing. It's something that I have processed and now can make funny. But you need that processing time in order to see the humor in your life sometimes.
Yes, for sure. And I think it's something that I can see as such an organic part of how you come across now, that even in the way you mentioned your experiences earlier in the conversation around depression and anxiety really just came up in a very natural way. That I think speaks to somebody that is used to having these conversations. And I think, you know, that's one of the things that I love getting to do through my work, whether it's through this, whether it's through, you know, comedy adjacent things I get to do as well, where, yes, have the stuff processed, but also there is still a journey you can go on with the audience of normalizing mm-hmm. the conversations. And I think that is lifelong.
Yes.
And yet at the same time, it's so beautiful to see. And I see it in myself. Sometimes I sort of look at my own conversations and have that like third party, like out of body moment where you're like, oh, you really just like talk about mental illness just whenever. There's just not a time when I'm holding it back. And it gets to a point where it's not purposeful. It's just you're not taking all those moments out of your day to shove it down anymore. And your comfort right. in talking about it, particularly if it's combined with humor, puts people so at ease.
Yes, absolutely. I could not, you stated it perfectly.
Oh. Well, thank you.
I mean, left, Your Honor.
That's what we're talking about, isn't it? I have had a lot of practice talking about this stuff.
That was beautiful. I think it's just that. The whole idea is vulnerability begets vulnerability. The more that you're able to talk about it, other people are suddenly able to see themselves talking about it too.
Yes. And off air, you mentioned something that you have come across that's been quite jarring, is that people haven't always got the link between a comedy show and your mission around suicide prevention. And mm-hmm. I'm very biased. I work with enough comedians where I know there's plenty of links, both within, you know, the comedians themselves, but also just kind of generally including the audience. But yeah, tell me what you see.
Yeah, I mean, you're spot on. If you're a comic, you're like, what? The connection is the thing. Like, that's why we're here. We have the thing, so we're on stage. But for other people...
So you can say it.
yeah. But for other people...
I wasn't
going to
be that direct.
It's like, what? They don't typically understand, but I think it's... You're going to be hard-pressed to listen to any comic's full line of work and not hear about their mental health. But that's the beauty, right? You don't go to comedy and think, oh, I got a mental health lesson. You go and you think, I laughed my ass off. Also, he made a really good point about that. That's the whole point of the show. It's like a spoonful of sugar to help the medicine go down. I gain permission within these rooms of college kids. I'm 34. I'm not cool anymore. Why would they listen to me? And it's because I'm willing to joke about things and say things out loud that they are shocked by. And so now I've got their attention. So while I've got their attention, why not give them a great message too? And that's how those two things overlap. It's not, you know, I'm not sitting up there for an hour roasting suicide or suicidal ideation. I don't have it in me. Like, that's not what I'm doing. And so I think that is immediately where some people are like, wait a minute, I can't laugh about that for an hour. Don't worry, you won't. But yes. I do think it's a good ticket in the door.
And I'm reminded of a recent comedy special I watched of Taylor Tomlinson, where she really calls this out in a way that I really loved. It was kind of, to me, very like Hannah Gadsby-esque to be like, here is how I'm going to deliver the joke. And you're going to forget that I've given this preamble and you're going to laugh along. And then you're going to think back and be like, oh, she really did that. And maybe I can too. The special was a lot around her difficulties with mental ill health and talking about, you know, really hard hitting topics, but being like, look, I'm going to talk about this stuff and we're going to have silly jokes, we're going to have serious moments, and in between you might even forget how serious the subject matter is. And I think I've lost my train of thought, but I think that's very powerful. I got a lot from it.
Absolutely. I could not be a bigger Taylor Tomlinson fan. I had the dry run of my tour on Friday, and Thursday night I watched her show twice in a row. And she is now on a separate tour with a completely new hour. Wow, what a genius. We love Taylor Tomlinson. And her new special is just gold. It is so vulnerable. It is so real. And it is so freaking funny. I laughed out loud so many times. And like, that's the goal right there.
Yeah. Because we want to relate. You know, we want to laugh, but we also want to connect and feel that we're in a space of like-minded individuals. And I think that's the power of laughter that can kind of go overlooked of being in a room. You know, there's a reason why comedy over Zoom is a challenge, and why we need, you know, the comedy clubs to be reopened and people to be laughing around straight. I mean, side note, I've done a lot of work in comedy clubs, and you'll know how much people want to, like, sit at the back, sit at the sides. There's a high table in the corner, and they want to be there. And it's like, you will not get the same experience. You need to be in the laughter. That is part of this.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same experience that people get from watching live music and being there and experiencing it in the crowd.
Mm-hmm.
There is nothing like a stand-up show that is just absolutely on fire. People are crying, laughing. It just feels so good to be in that room. You just know things are going to be okay, mm-hmm. whatever's going on.
Yes. Yeah, you get to step away and be like, we're all on the same page in a world mm-hmm. that feels so divided, and we need it. And you mentioned specifically around going into colleges. We haven't touched on that yet. Could you share, so, the details of the tour and where you're going with it and why?
Yeah, absolutely. So I created this comedy tour about mental health, and it stops solely at sorority houses across the nation and the United States. So the first leg of the tour is in the South, which is exciting for us. That means Florida, Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, and Texas. So sorority houses for a reason. One is, like, starting a tour as a comic and it just being me, I only have two hands. But if you book with sororities, it removes the ticketing process. So that's why we did that. And then I was also the social chair in my sorority. So I knew that they were booking talent like myself, and they had the budget for it. And I also knew, like, who at the sorority I needed to be reaching out to. So with that, we are stopping right now at 14 different sororities over the next month.
I love that. I love the networking of it as well. You're like, I know these girls. I know who to speak to.
Yeah, I'm like, you are me. Well, that's the whole point of the thing, right? You were me years ago. we won't go into how many specific years ago, but I just wish I had this talk when I was their age.
Yes. And I can definitely see the motivation with, you know, what you are looking to prevent and getting into this young age. I'm majorly involved in mental health education for the same reason, because you can look back and see how preventable a lot of awful situations can be if we'd had even something, some education, please.
I love that, the word preventable. Absolutely. I think that is spot on. That's what wakes me up in the morning, is that this is preventable. Like I said, I like to fix things. Not that I think I'm going to fix suicide, but sure as hell gonna try.
I love and respect that so much. And we will wrap up there, but we are going to jump onto another interview, which the listeners will hear tomorrow if they listen to my other podcast, Dating Games, the Modern Relationships podcast. So if you want more Stephanie, you don't have to wait long. But if they really can't wait, could you share a little bit about where people can find you online? And you also have a podcast of your own.
Absolutely. So you can find me online on Instagram at SLU Foster, FOSTER, or you can follow the comedy tour that's going to be stopping at the sorority houses at Without Rhyme Nor Reason. And then what were your other questions? My podcast, it's called Petrol Llama, and it will be making a transition into live podcasts at each of the sororities we stop at on tour. So you'll get to meet the women that we're speaking to and listen to our conversations.
Yes. And I feel like we should tease the listeners, not give any context on what Petrol Llama is. You're just going to have to go check it out, but it's a good show.
Good. Love it.
And now we'll say goodbye, even though we're going to be talking for another hour. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember,
you are enough.